It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, with all the news about impeachment and the 2020 presidential race, the caucuses coming up, a lot of other important news hasn't been getting much attention lately. This half hour, let's get back to the topic of immigration and hear the perspectives of three Iowa women who have recently traveled to the U.S.-Mexican border to assist refugees. But before we go to them in our studio, let's get a snapshot of the current border situation with Rinaldo Leanos Jr. He is a border and immigration reporter with Texas Public Radio. Rinaldo, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What issues have you been reporting on concerning the border there lately?
Yeah, so right now, I mean, a lot of my reporting has been on border wall construction and, you know, landowners fighting upcoming border wall construction projects. But also, I mean, a big chunk of my reporting right now, especially since September, has been on asylum seekers in Mexico, and specifically in Matamoros, Mexico, which is right across the Rio Grande from Brownsville, Texas, at the southern tip of the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm. And there have been changes in the way asylum seekers are processed and reviewed, where they may be held. Tell us briefly about that.
So I think one of the biggest changes that we've seen is the implementation of this program that the federal government calls the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP. And it's basically changed the way we deal with asylum seekers, because before, asylum seekers were allowed to wait in the U.S. and, you know, wait with family members if they had them there, which a lot of them do. And now, instead of waiting in the U.S. for their asylum claims to, like, unfold and go through the immigration courts, now they're being forced to remain in Mexico for several months. And as of right now, there's been more than 57,000 asylum seekers who have been forced to wait in Mexico as their asylum claims, you know, unfold and go through the courts in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. You've been in contact with these asylum seekers. What experiences have you had? What can you tell us about their condition, their outlook, their situation?
Yes. So I've been reporting on this since MPP unfolded in the Rio Grande Valley, which was around September. And one of the things that has happened is that a tent city has emerged in Matamoros, and there are more than 2,000 asylum seekers currently living in Matamoros. And so what that kind of looks like is just people camping out in tents, you know, and it's not, and these people are waiting there for months, you know, as their immigration courts unfold in the U.S. And I was speaking to a Cuban asylum seeker recently who had been in Matamoros since about April, you know, and so families are having to live, you know, in these conditions. They don't have access to clean water. You know, they don't have access to, like, medical needs and stuff because the U.S. government isn't helping, and neither is the Mexican government. So a lot of the help that does come is from aid workers.
So briefly, before we say goodbye, Rinaldo, can you give us a sense of the most common reasons these people are seeking asylum in the U.S.?
So, I mean, I've spoken to so many asylum seekers at this point, you know, and the reoccurring theme is that a lot of them are fleeing violence back in their home countries, you know, and every country is different for the different things that they face. I mean, I've spoken to people in Venezuela and Cuba who are also fleeing, you know, oppression by those governments and stuff, for being politically, you know, opposed to the government. So there's various reasons, you know, but I would say that most of the people that I've spoken to are fleeing some sort of violence and fear of persecution back in their home countries.
Right. And Rinaldo, before you go, what is their outlook under the new processing reviewing system we have here in the U.S.?
Yeah, so it's hard to say. I mean, I had seen a stat that said that asylum seekers, you know, are not getting, you know, a lot of, they're not getting the protection, you know, they're not being granted asylum. But there's so many reasons for that. You know, there is no due process for them. I mean, asylum seekers are not guaranteed an automatic lawyer. You know, I mean, these are people who are coming from other countries who have to defend themselves in U.S. immigration courts. I mean, these are people who, I mean, there's just so many layers to this conversation, you know, but it's hard to say what their outlook looks like, especially because they're not being given the tools necessary, you know, to actually, you know, complete an asylum case correctly.
Okay. Rinaldo Leanos Jr., border and immigration reporter with Texas Public Radio. Thank you for giving us a picture of what's happening on the U.S.-Texas border, Rinaldo.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now we're joined by three Iowa women who have recently traveled to the U.S.-Mexican border to assist refugees. So let's find out more about what they've been doing. We're joined by Deb Schollerman, Sally Hartman, and Sue Otto. Ladies, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
Now, you've traveled at different times. Sally, I believe you were in September and November. Deb, you were in December. And Sue, you just returned a matter of, what, a day or two ago?
Right, this weekend.
Okay.
This last weekend.
Okay, very good. Sue, let me start with you. Tell us why you've taken this trip.
Well, I have worked a bit with local immigrants who are learning English. Always been interested in immigration policies for our government. And because I'm a Spanish speaker, I'm particularly interested in Hispanics who are seeking asylum in the U.S. And so when teams from my church, the Unitarian Universalist Society, formed up and went south, I said, I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try to do something.
Important to know, you all three are members of the Unitarian Universalist Society in the Iowa City Coralville
right.
area, and there are about a dozen of you total, I believe, from this congregation that that has thus far traveled to the border. Sally, let me ask you, tell me about your trip. What did you find there? What was your goal going there?
Well, my goal was to better understand what was happening and also just to provide some kind of relief for people that were suffering, especially children. That was a big draw for me because the family separation issue earlier was heartbreaking, and I thought if I could do a little something for the children, that would be very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. So the media reports, of course, covered comprehensively the separation of children, the policy that was big in the news for months here. Sally, did you find a situation that matched up with the news reports that you went beforehand?
I wasn't prepared. I was so astounded that there were people living in tents and then other people not even having tents, begging cardboard to have something to sleep on at
This is
night.
In the U.S. side of the border?
No, this is in Matamoros.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the tent city that was being described by our earlier guest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, I spoke to several fathers who had sent their children over by themselves to meet family members across and were still waiting on the Matamoros side to get asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Deb Schollerman, tell us about your experience going in December. What did you find? What stands out in your memory?
I think primarily how many tents. So there were thousands of tents probably. And the living situations that Sally mentioned earlier. And I think reassuring is not the word, but it was heartening to see all the volunteers from Brownsville who are organizing to bring supplies of food and meals. All those tents have been donated by people in Brownsville, or people have sent money so they can buy tents. So there's been a lot of volunteer support from Brownsville, people crossing every day. When you cross, you bring things in wagons, and the people see you, oh, you're bringing supplies. And sometimes people would come up to us, oh, you have blankets. Can I please have a blanket?
Mm-hmm.
So it was rewarding to see that the American people are responding to the crisis on the border.
Primarily Latino Americans or all types of Americans?
All types.
Are you all three Spanish speakers?
Yes.
So you're well equipped to communicate with them. I'd like to hear some of the stories that you heard. When we talked to our reporter earlier, I asked him about the reasons they were seeking asylum, these people that you met. What did you hear out there? Sue?
I don't know where to begin, actually.
Yeah, pick out one story, one family, perhaps.
Well, I think there were a number of instances where, you know, I talked about the people who were letting their wives and children go and staying behind. But the other thing that is true of the camp in general is a lot of food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to more than one mother when I gave her something to eat who said, I gave my food this morning to my child so that my child could have something to eat. there are so many stories that are heartbreaking that happen on the border. It's just, it's really amazing. The other thing that happens there is that water is still a big issue, even though between the time when Sally went first and our time, there are big tanks of water. But the water is not particularly safe, according to what we heard. So one of the local organizers who is working independently got a doctor, his name is Dr. Caleb Simmons, who sent hundreds of individual water filters. And so we were taking those across, and people were very grateful for that.
So you were taking these microfilters,
yes,
that can filter out any microorganisms.
Viruses, bacteria, all of that. Mm-hmm. So
what was your other work there, Sally?
Well, one of the stories I heard was a woman from Venezuela who was a single mom. She was a teacher in Venezuela, but she spoke out against the government. And she felt her life was in danger. She had to find a way to try to get to the United States to seek asylum. So she had to cross over to Colombia and then take transportation to Mexico. And she was afraid of the safety issues in the tent city with a young child and her being alone.
Mm-hmm. Could you sense that those safety issues were real concerns?
Yeah, I talked to one woman whose husband had been killed by a local gang.
There's lots of gangs in this tent city or near?
No, in her village.
I see, and that's why she was fleeing.
There were people from Salvador, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, some from Guatemala, some from Cuba. But what happened then is that she just fled with her children. She was living in fear of the violence around her, and she was there hoping to be able to get into the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I heard similar stories from mostly women who had fled with their children because it is too violent where I am living. And I know this neighbor went to work one day, never came back. And so there, people are living in fear. And I think to make a decision to leave your community and go north and know not what you're going to come across is a difficult decision. But I think people are so desperate with the violence that they're exposed to and living with in some of these communities. They have no other choice.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting a sense from your stories that when we talk about whether these are people fleeing violence or merely economic refugees trying to improve their lives, it's in the former category. People fleeing, fleeing from their homelands.
Yes, that's the impression I got.
Yeah, there is both. There are people trying to escape poverty because there is a lot of poverty, and particularly Guatemala. But yeah, we heard stories about both. Mm-hmm. I'm going to speak a second to the infrastructure. When Sally was there in September, I think there were 5 porta potties for 1,000 people, and now there are almost 40. In December. So the Mexican government is doing a little bit to help support the infrastructure, but it's not nearly enough. When I was helping in the medical clinic, talking to that run by Global Response Management, talking to Helen Perry, she has set up other refugee medical clinics, particularly in Syria, and she said she's never seen anything with this little infrastructure for refugees.
Sally, speak to that, because you were there in September and then again in November. You saw change.
Right. So the only way that people could bathe or wash their clothes was in the river. And if they had any cuts or anything, that their cuts would become infected. So they tried to keep as clean as they could, but it was very challenging. And the porta potties were overflowing because there were only a few for a lot of people. Hmm. So also there was a lack of food.
If you've just joined us, my guests are 3 Iowa women who have recently traveled to the U.S.-Mexican border to assist refugees, to observe the situation, get a better sense of what's going on there, and to help out in various ways. Deb Schollerman, Sally Hartman, and Sue Otto are all members of the Unitarian Universalist Society in the Iowa City Coralville area. You are working, I understand, with a group, a local group there in Texas called the Angry Tias
group in South Texas, Angry Tias. Tia is Spanish for aunt, I understand. Tell us about this group that you partnered with.
Well, they were formed originally when the crisis happened with our government separating children from refugee children from their families. Even infants were separated. So they formed a group to try to address that issue. Since that has changed, they've shifted their focus to providing aid and assistance to the asylum seekers who are detained on that side of the border. So they provide a lot of material support. And on the Brownsville side, there's even legal support that's that are helping them. They provide clothing, medical supplies, things for children to do, a lot of help.
You've all made at least one trip. Are you going to make more, Deb?
Actually, I am going back the first week of March. Yes.
You are. It's already planned.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you, Sally.
Yeah,
and,
I'll probably go back.
Yeah, you just returned. So
I
you
just
need
got
a,
back.
Maybe
I'm
a little bit of a rest. Is it exhausting?
It is.
In what way?
Psychologically very exhausting to see so much misery, such difficult living conditions. One of the things is that now, I think it wasn't true before, but there are a lot of open cooking fires. So they're cooking for people, and the smoke from that makes it really hard to breathe in some places in the encampment. So I think things have changed. There are lots of threats. They're now talking about deporting Mexicans to Guatemala. That's our government again. When I was there were signs posted that said the I-589 forms for the applications for asylum were not moving. They were not being realized at that point. So there are these bottlenecks, these breaks that have been put on from people who are seeking asylum.
How many others from around the country are there? You're three of about a dozen in the Iowa City, Coralville area. Are there are other parts of the country joining in the same way, or is this a unique pocket, Sally?
When we were there, we met people from Pennsylvania, Virginia, Massachusetts, Indiana. People were coming from all over to do what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical clinic has volunteer physicians coming from all over the country.
Mm-hmm. How has this changed you, the trips you've taken there? You've consumed it up to this point. I know you're all Spanish speakers. You've consumed with interest the media here. How does actually visiting the place, visiting this tent city, changed you all?
Well, but beyond the new understanding of what's really happening down there, it's given me new resolve to continue to be politically active.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been very involved with the campaign already, and I certainly will continue to do that and advocate for immigration policies that are more humane.
Mm-hmm. Deb, Sally, how has it changed you?
I think I just have more insight into the intricacies of extreme poverty and horrific living conditions, and that there are lots of helpers and lots of heroes, the teachers that go there, the lawyers, doctors and nurses, reporters. But the real heroes are the parents who keep their kids clean, who wash their clothes and put them on bushes to dry, and just keep discipline with their children, and I'm thinking that the parents are the true heroes.
Mm. Deb, your thoughts?
I agree with what they said, and I think one of the things that we bring is we bring a little bit of hope, a little bit of compassion, and since I'm able to do that, that's why I'm going, because I'm able to do it.
Hope. What is it? Tell me more about the reaction of the people you're helping out. How do they react to you when they see you come? And do they even know where Iowa is?
No, probably not. I mean, I'd always just say go north for 2 days in a car and you're there. But I got a lot of hugs, especially from children. And always thanks for things that we were doing. And people would come and see us with wagons and come up and thank us.
Yeah.
It's very gratifying.
And one thing that surprised me was the connections that we made with people, especially if you can speak Spanish, is you just form connections right away and friendships. And so when they went back, go talk to Edwin and go talk to Alejandra. And
do you think these are long-lasting connections that maybe you will follow over years?
Well, if we have their...
It's hard to have contact information.
They're not stuck there forever.
They hardly have internet when they don't have some of the basic necessities, do they?
Well, actually, there are stations to charge devices because they do need to be contacted when they get their court dates. They need to know when those are so that they can cross over. Mm-hmm. So there are some devices, not computers particularly, but smartphones.
Almost everybody has a cell phone, almost.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And the reporter you had earlier that we were listening to, he talked about not enough due process. There are not enough attorneys. People you go to your court date, and if you don't have an attorney, and particularly a bilingual attorney, then you're on your own. And that's just a whole nother mess is the due process that he mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how do people find out more about what you're doing? Is there a way online to find out about these types of actions that you know of, Sally?
Right. So I would just go and look up Angry TS or Team Brownsville. Also, if you're if you have a medical background, you could contact Global Response Management.
Mm-hmm. Angry TS, TIAS. I just want to make sure people knew that spelling as well. Okay, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences. Sally Hartman, Deb Schollerman, and Sue Otto, three women from the Iowa City Coralville area at the Unitarian Universalist Society who've been traveling to the Mexican-U.S. border to help asylum seekers. Thank you very much for telling us about it.
Thanks for having us.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.